Welcome to the deep dive. Okay, let's unpack this. We're diving into an economic shift so huge, some experts are calling it the largest macroeconomic imbalance the world has ever seen.
Quite a statement.
It really is. We're focusing today on China's current economic situation and, maybe more importantly, the ripple effects, how it impacts the U.S., the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
We've looked at analyses from people like Kyle Bass, Lance Roberts, trying to get a clear picture.
Some sharp minds looking at this.
Right. So our mission, really, for this deep dive is to cut through all the noise, get to the surprising facts, you know, help you understand the core mechanics of what's going on and why it actually matters to your financial world.
And what's fascinating here is seeing how these huge global forces, they actually translate into real world shifts, stuff that affects global trade, yes, but also potentially your own investment decisions. We'll try to connect those dots.
Exactly. So to really get it, we have to start at the source, right? The core problems in China's economy. Kyle Bass, he puts it very bluntly. He says China's economy is spiraling with no end in sight.
Spiraling. That's strong language.
Yeah. And he blames policy missteps, systemic financial rot, and a rapidly eroding growth engine.
Mm.
The key thing he argues is that this isn't just like a temporary dip. It's fundamental, baked into the system almost.
And the main driver he points to, and many others agree, is China's real estate sector, which is just massive. It accounts for something like 30% of their entire GDP.
30%?
Yeah, it's huge. And we're seeing it collapse. Developers defaulting, sales volumes just falling off a cliff, home prices going down in major cities.
And this isn't totally new, right? The ghost cities thing.
Exactly. That's been building for years, this overbuilding.
Yeah.
It's kind of reached its limit. Bass has this quote, "They're sitting on 60 to 70 million vacant homes. It's a Ponzi scheme that is finally collapsing."
60 to 70 million. It's hard to wrap your head around that number.
It really is. It's staggering.
And this collapse, it's not just about empty apartments. It's causing these broader deflationary pressures. So prices actually falling across the economy.
Which sounds maybe okay initially, but it's usually a sign of deep economic trouble.
Right. And it's also feeding this slow motion banking crisis, hitting their shadow banking system particularly hard.
Mm.
You know, the less regulated financial stuff.
Mm-hmm. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the government's response, the CCP's response is, well, critical here. They seem to be rejecting transparency, rejecting market-based fixes.
So what are they doing instead?
They're opting for more control. Things like capital restrictions, direct state intervention, more financial surveillance. Basically doubling down on control rather than letting the market sort things out.
Which, economically speaking, is problematic.
Very. Because it kind of traps the bad debt in the system. It undermines confidence, which is exactly what they need to stabilize things. It prioritizes political control over economic health, really.
So the upshot is, experts are talking about a permanent shift toward zero or negative real growth for China. Not just a recession, but something structural.
That seems to be the emerging consensus, yes.
Mm-hmm.
A fundamental change, not just a cycle.
Okay. So if China's engine is sputtering, where does all that money go? Capital doesn't just disappear, right? It moves.
Exactly, it moves. And this inevitable exodus, as Bayes calls it, is potentially a seismic macroeconomic event. Huge waves in global capital markets.
And why is it moving? Just fear.
It's a profound reevaluation of risk. Confidence in China's financial system is eroding. So both Chinese money and foreign investment are, well, they're doing everything it can to escape.
Trying to get out.
When trust breaks down like that, capital doesn't just slow down, it flees. It looks for safety.
So what does this all mean for you, for people listening? Where does all this fleeing capital actually land?
Well, that brings us to the dollar.
Yeah, because for years we've heard this death of the dollar narrative. Is that just...
Wrong. Based on this analysis, yes, it seems vastly exaggerated.
Okay.
What's fascinating here is why the dollar stays on top. There are a few key reasons. One is simply the lack of a viable alternative currency at that scale.
Nothing else can really handle that volume.
Not with the same depth and trust, no. And then there's the underlying strength of the U.S. economy itself. Plus, you have these network effects.
Meaning everyone uses it, so everyone keeps using it?
Sort of, yeah. It becomes the default standard for trade and reserves. It's just convenient and entrenched, and has shown resilience. So far from weakening the dollar, China's problems actually seem to be reinforcing its role. It exacerbates the world's dependence on the U.S. dollar.
Right, because in a crisis, investors aren't looking for the highest return.
They're looking for safety, exactly. In times of crisis, investors don't seek yield, they seek safety.
And the safest place, perceived safest place, is still U.S. dollar assets, like treasury bonds.
Precisely. The U.S. dollar and treasury bonds are seen as the premier safe havens. There's really no alternative with the same depth, liquidity, and perceived security.
Even with all the U.S. debt and deficits we hear about.
Even with that, the mechanics are pretty straightforward. Global capital floods into dollars, and a lot of that goes straight into U.S. treasuries. It's the biggest, most liquid government bond market in the world.
So that demand pushes treasury prices up and yields down.
Correct. Even while the U.S. is issuing record amounts of debt, and it's crucial to grasp the mindset here, they aren't buying for big returns. They're buying for the guaranteed return of capital, not necessarily a high return on capital. Safety first.
Getting your money back is priority number one.
Absolutely. It's a fundamental shift in risk appetite.
Okay, let's shift gears slightly. Think about the U.S.-China relationship historically. For a long time, the U.S. kind of benefited, right? We exported inflation and imported deflation.
That's a good way to put it. We benefited from China's cheap labor, their huge demand for goods.
Yeah.
It kept prices low for American consumers.
But that's changing now, reversing.
It seems to be, yes. A structurally weakened China means less trade overall, less demand for American products and services, slower investment flows back and forth.
Which hits U.S. companies.
Right. U.S. multinational earnings come under pressure, and it could lead to lower nominal GDP growth in the U.S. The overall economic pie might grow slower, partly because prices aren't rising as fast, or might even fall.
And here's where it gets really interesting. Could the Fed be making a mistake on inflation? A transitory mistake.
That's a major risk highlighted in the analysis. If China is exporting deflation, or at least disinflation.
Meaning slowing inflation?
Yes. If those pressures go global, it could counteract domestic inflation here more than expected. Remember, inflation is basically supply and demand. If global growth slows significantly because of China,
then demand falls and inflation should cool down naturally.
Exactly. It complicates the picture for central banks significantly.
And this goes back to Bass's point. This isn't just a temporary slump for China.
Right. If it's a permanent shift towards zero or negative real growth, as he suggests, that changes the entire outlook for global growth for potentially years to come.
So let's bring it home. What does this all mean for your investments, your financial planning?
Well, the core suggestion is a shift in mindset. Moving away from primarily asking, where can I grow my capital, towards where can I protect it?
Preservation over aggressive growth.
In this kind of environment, yes. The analysis suggests that traditional drivers of market performance will take a backseat to macro stability and risk management. It becomes more about weathering the storm.
And the place to weather the storm, according to this, is still
the U.S. Treasury market. Even with the U.S.'s own fiscal issues, that's where capital seems to prefer to hide when global uncertainty spikes.
It really underscores that idea about capital, doesn't it?
It does. Capital doesn't care about ideology. It cares about trust, liquidity, and rule of law. When trust evaporates in a major economy like China,
capital doesn't just walk away.
They run. They seek environments offering that perceived safety and stability above all else.
Which leads to that analogy that the U.S., despite its own problems, is still the cleanest shirt in a very dirty laundry pile.
It's a stark analogy, but it captures the relative safe haven appeal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the key takeaway is that this shift feels significant, not temporary. It seems like a deeper reordering of global economic leadership and risk tolerance, something you really need to factor into your long-term thinking.
Okay, so just to quickly recap the main points of this deep dive, we've looked at China's deep economic problems, especially that huge real estate crisis causing deflation and banking stress. We saw how that's leading to capital fleeing China.
The inevitable exodus.
And flowing predominantly into the U.S. dollar and treasuries, making the dollar stronger despite those death of the dollar stories.
Right. Debunking that narrative, essentially.
We talked about how this flips the old dynamic. China might now export disinflation to the U.S., potentially pressuring growth and company earnings here.
And complicating things for the Fed.
And finally, the big takeaway for you, the listener. Maybe shifting focus from pure growth to capital preservation, with U.S. Treasuries being the default safe haven in this environment.
That's a good summary. And looking ahead, this raises an important question. As we see this potential reordering happening, what are the long-term implications? for the whole idea of economic superpowers.
Yeah.
And how might this reshape, you know, global cooperation or maybe competition in the next decade or so?
That's definitely something to think about. Consider how these huge global shifts might filter down, how they could eventually impact your local economy, your community, and your own financial decisions. Because these big waves, they do eventually reach the shore.